ಸಾಂಜಿತಂ ತಂ ಸಜೀವಂ ಸಾಧ್ವೈತಂ ಸಾಧುತಂ ಶ್ರೀ ರಾಧಾಕೃಷ್ಣ ಪಾದಾನ ಸಹಗಾ ಶ್ರೀ ವಿಶಾಖಾಂಶಂ ಓಂ ವಿಷ್ಣು ಪಾದಾಯ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಕೃಷ್ಣಾಯ ಭೂತಲೆ ಶ್ರೀಮತೇ ಭಕ್ತಿ ವೇದಾಂತ ಸ್ವಾಮಿ ನಾಮಿನೇ ನಮಸ್ತೆ ಸರಸ್ವತಿ ದೇವೆ ಗೌರವಾಣಿ ಪ್ರಚಾರಣೆ ನಿರ್ವಿಶೇಷ ಶೂನ್ಯವಾದ ಪಾಶ್ಚಾತ್ಯ ದೇಶಕಾರಣೆ ನಮೋ ಮಹಾವದನ್ಯಾಯ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಪ್ರೇಮ ಪ್ರದಾಯತೆ ಕೃಷ್ಣಾಯ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಚೈತನ್ಯ ನಾಮೇ ಗೌರತಿಶೇ ನಮಃ ಹೇ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಕರುಣಾ ಸಿಂಧೋ ದೀನಬಂಧೋ ಜಗತ್ಪತೆ ಕೋಟಿಕಾಂತ ನಮೋಸ್ತುತೆ ತಪ್ತ ಕಾಂಚನ ಗೌರಾಂಗೇ ರಾಧೆ ಬೃಂದಾವನೇಶ್ವರಿ ಋಷಭಾನೋ ಕ್ರಮಾಮಿ ಹರಿ ಪ್ರಿಯ ವಾಚಾ ಕಲ್ಪತರೂಪೇಶ್ಚ ಕೃಪಾ ಸಿಂಧುಭ್ಯ ಚ ಪತ್ನಿತಾನಾ ಪಾವನೇಭ್ಯೋ ವೈಷ್ಣವೇಭ್ಯೋ ನಮೋ ನಮಃ ಜಯ ಶ್ರೀ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಚೈತನ್ಯ ಪ್ರಭು ನಿತ್ಯಾನಂದ ಶ್ರೀ ಅದ್ವೈತ ಸದಾಧಾರ ಶ್ರೀವಾಸಾದಿ ಗೌರಭಕ್ತವೃಂದ ಹರೇ ಕೃಷ್ಣ 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 ಹರೇ 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 ರಾಮ ಹರೇ ರಾಮ 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 ಪ್ರಪನ್ನ ಪಾರಿಜಾತಾಯ ಸ್ತೋತ್ರವೇತ್ರೈಕಪಾಣಯೇ ಜ್ಞಾನಮುದ್ರಾಯ ಕೃಷ್ಣಾಯ ಗೀತಾಮೃತದುಹೇ ನಮಃ ಹರೇ ಕೃಷ್ಣ. After about a month, we continue our Bhagavad Gita. So we will be doing the concluding part of the third chapter today, verses 36 to 43. Before that, a quick overview of the third chapter. The third chapter begins with Arjuna's question, which is better? If knowledge is better, then why are you engaging me in this ghastly warfare? And Krishna does not specifically answer that question in one verse, but rather analyzes the hierarchy which is implicitly stated in the second chapter. So from 3.3 to 9, Krishna is basically talking about how karma yoga is superior to jnana yoga, how for person of his qualification karma yoga is better than jnana yoga, or although objectively jnana yoga might be better than karma yoga. Then the next section he talks from 3.10 to 16 is karma kanda. So he is taking different situations. If Arjuna thinks that Krishna is telling him that you are not qualified for jnana yoga, therefore you should do karma yoga. But if you think you are not even qualified for karma yoga, if you are very attached not just to the work, but even to the fruits of work, even then you should do karmakanda. And karmakanda involves doing your duty. Then from 3.17 to 25, he talks about how, if you think that you are already qualified, not just for karma yoga, but for jnana yoga, then still, for the sake of setting an example for others, you should fight. And then from 25 to 35, he is talking about the difference between attached work and detached work, or rather something like difference between karma yoga and we can have everything else, karma kanda and vikarma, all of them come in that category. So the last section concludes by telling how Arjuna should stick to his duty without being subjected to attachment and aversion. So now Krishna's statements create a question in Arjuna's mind. Yes, we all make resolutions to stick to our duty, but there is something which destroys our good resolves, destroys our good intentions, and makes us act in wrong ways. So what is it that prevents us from following the path of duty? So this is the connection between this section on lust and the previous chapter that is going on. Because the essential attribute of Karma Yoga is detachment. And the essential attribute of lust is attachment. So in that sense, lust prevents us from practicing Karma Yoga, from being detached from our work. So that's what Arjuna is asking, what is it that makes us act wrongly in spite of our not wanting to do so? So let us recite the verse together. Arjuna Vacha, together. Arjuna Vacha, Atha Tena Prayuktoyam Papam Charati Purushaha Anichchanapi Vachneya Baladivan Yojitaha. Yes, translation.
Arjuna says, O descendant of Rishni, by what is one impelled to sinful acts, even unwillingly, as if engaged by force?
No. Anichchan apivarshneya. So now, everything that is told in scripture is not necessarily an objective truth. There are statements in scriptures which can be subjective feelings. For example, in the Chitrakedu section, or even the Gopis section, the Gopis are cursing the providence. How foolish and cruel you are. You bring people together and before their relationships are led to satisfaction, you separate them. You don't have any intelligence. Now, is this the stand of the scripture? No, isn't it? So, the scripture sometimes talk about the Purva Paksha. Purva Paksha is the opposite party. So, they may sometimes use the view of the Purva Paksha and that is given so that it can be countered. And many times the opponents of Vedic culture take these verses out and say this is the position of the Vedic scriptures. So here, what is the Purva Paksha? Anichchanapi Varshneya. Although I do not desire to do it, still I do it. Still something forces me to do it. Now actually nothing can force us to do it against our anything, against our desire primarily. Ultimately we desire it. But what Arjuna is telling over here is that normally we don't desire to do anything wrong, but suddenly some force seems to take over our mind and at that time we actually desire it and we do it. But that is not our normal desire. So in that sense, anichchanapi varshneya. So, our desires are very, very unsteady. And that's why, that is the nature of the mind in Rajoguna, that it desires one thing at one moment and next moment rejects that thing and desires something else. And especially with respect to those who are trying to come towards Sattvaguna, either because of some transcendental objective or just because of some pious culture and upbringing, they often look back at life and they feel that life is blotted, tainted by some spates of madness in their life. You know, we just look back, why did I act like that? Why did I do like that? So now when we look back, anichchanapi vashna, I never wanted to do like that. You know, we can very easily feel that with respect to anger. When we get angry, we speak such things which we ourselves regret. How could I have spoken like this? The same applies to lust, same applies to greed, to a lesser degree. Because when we become angry, what results is very graphic. So, with respect to lust and greed, it may not be so explicitly visible. Although eventually it does become visible. But anichchanapi vashneya. And he says, there's two words, we don't normally desire it, but at that particular time when we act like that, it is baladivaniyojita. It is some very powerful force seems to impel us, as Prabhupada uses the word, seems to impel or compel us to act in that way. So, Arjuna is asking, what is that force which prevents us from following the path of duty? Now, Krishna will give a specific answer and then will elaborate the answer. So Srila Prabhupada explains that the super soul is present in the heart. And the implication of Arjuna's question is that actually the Lord is present in the heart. Now, this has not been stated explicitly in the Gita till now, but that is implicit knowledge in Vedic culture. So, the principle of sarvasya chaham hrudi sannivishto is something which is implicit. So, God's presence in the heart is understood by most Vedic followers. So, the implication of Arjuna's question is, isn't that that presence of God in the heart is forcing me to do this? Why would you do that? Because, in one sense, God is given as the path of dharma, and there is a force from within which is pushing us towards adharma. So, what is that force? Where does it come from? That's his question. So, Srila Prabhupada in the purport will explain that actually it is not the super soul who is forcing. Because in the heart the super soul is there, but along with that, there are many other forces also. So let's discuss that next verse together. Shri Bhagavan Vacha Kamesha Krodesha Rajo Gunasamudhavaha Mahakshana Mahapapma Vidyena Miha Vairinam.
Translation. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, it is lust only, Arjuna, which is born of contact with the material mode of passion and later transformed into wrath, and which is the all-devouring sinful enemy of this world.
So most of these verses are very, very power-packed, as we say in modern parlance. You know, every word of it has a lot of meaning. So, kama esha krodhesha. Esha means this. It is lust. And krodhesha. The lust. And which is transformed into. Prabhupada does not use the word anger. Prabhupada uses the word wrath. Now, wrath is a very, very strong form of anger. So, wrath. Rajoguna-samudbhava. So, how does it start off? It starts off with the mode of passion. Sam udbhava. Udbhava means to be obtained or to be born. Sam udbhava means to be born with it. So, with the mode of passion, lust is born. Rajoguna samudbhavaha. And maha shana. So, shana is related with the word, you know, ashnami prayatatmanha. Where does that word come? Patram pushpam phalam tam. So, Krishna says, whatever you offer, you accept. So, even lust also is maha shana. You know, it doesn't wait for us to offer, it grabs it, it devours. Mahashano Mahapapma. It's greatly sinful. Viddhi. Viddhi means know this. So Viddhi is different from Viddhi. Viddhi means regulations. There's Viddhi and there's the more emphatic the sound. It is know it to be. Tad Viddhi Pranipatena. So know it, that this is what you should do, Arjuna. Go to a spiritual master. Viddhi enam, this lust, iha vairinam. Vairinam means the enemy. Iha is in this world. So now, here we see Krishna taking the whole dialogue to a different dimension. And the immediate dimension of the Bhagavad Gita is that the Kauravas are the enemies, and the other soldiers and the kings on the side of the Arjuna are the allies. But Krishna is taking the dialogue to a higher level by using the word that actually the enemy in this world is not Duryodhana, Dhritarashtra, Dushyasana or whoever, it is lust only. So the Bhagavad Gita is not a book primarily of violence. It is a book of purification. And for purification, every one of us has to follow certain discipline. And those who refuse to follow the discipline, those who rather not only stay impure, but spread impurity, against them violence may have to be used. But even that violence is not exercised in a vengeful sense, it is also exercised in a compassionate sense. So, even when Arjuna is going to kill the Kauravas, the Kshatriya modality may involve talking about revenge and anger and words like that, but the primary motive is actually to establish dharma. So Arjuna is not in that sense materially vengeful against the Kauravas, Because the Kauravas have surrendered to lust instead of surrendering to Krishna, so the way to purify them from lust is by actually disconnecting them from their lust contaminated bodies so that they become purified. So the enemy actually is lust. Yavairinam Mahashino Mahapapma. It's an all devouring sinful enemy. So Mahashino is very significant, because you know, for lust nothing is sacred. Generally speaking, when we are all struggling at our conditioned stage to fight with lust, so we all feel that at times we feel that the rules of Krishna consciousness are very strict, and there should be some latitude, some leniency, because sometimes we feel that this is being too fanatical. Yes, that's why in the Vedic culture there is Brahmacharya Ashram and there is Grihastha Ashram also. But it is not that even Grihastha Ashram is a license for indulging in lust. Because when a person becomes lusty, you know, when we say love is blind, actually that means lust is blind. And the blindness of lust is such that, like we see in our modern times, there is not even attraction to the opposite sex. Now we have homosexuality and we have bisexuality. And just a couple of weeks ago there was an article in the newspaper about how a father wanted to rape his daughter. And when she refused to submit to him, he murdered her, 9-year-old daughter. So it's so horrifying to hear such things. What does that mean? That means actually lust literally is blind. Once we indulge in it, then it's Mahashano. Actually, Mahashano means a great devourer. But Prabhupada takes it further and says, all devourer. It's all devouring sinful enemy. Therefore, there is no limit to, if a person succumbs to lust, actually there is no limit to how much lust can drag a person down. And therefore, as devotees, we always have to try to keep ourselves within the Lakshman Rekha of Dharma. Because once we go out of that Lakshman Rekha, you know, how far we'll be dragged down, nobody can say. So although it is, Krishna conscious rules may seem very strict, but actually they are protective. Once we go out of these rules, there is really no limit. Generally speaking, the mind always misdiagnoses the cause of our suffering or dissatisfaction. All our dissatisfaction is because of alienation from Krishna, forgetfulness of Krishna, distancing from Krishna. But not recognizing that, not acknowledging that, the mind makes us feel that the dissatisfaction is because of the lack of sense objects in our life. So the mind is, come on, take the sense object. Take the sense object and try to enjoy. And then we chase after that. And then when we get to that sense object, it gives some pleasure, but then the pleasure is short-lived. And then the mind doesn't realize the point that, oh, this is not going to make me happy. The mind, come on, chase the next sense object. Another sense object. Another sense object. And generally, when a person enjoys at one level, the next time the person doesn't want to, is not satisfied with enjoyment at that level, he wants to go down to a greater level. That's why, you know, in some Christian traditions, there was the original saying that there should be no intoxication. But the modern Christians, they say, drink but don't get drunk. Now it's not possible. They say you can drink, but drink moderately, drink but don't get drunk. But it doesn't work like that. Why? Because one drink once in a week or once a month, that doesn't satisfy the mind's craving for pleasure. Yes, there is a little high which a person may experience, but that high is very disappointingly short. And therefore the mind says, oh, I got this high. If I drink more, I'll get more high. And more high. And that's why the mind just drags a person down and down. So it's the analogy of the fish out of water. So you know, the suffering of the fish is because of coming out of the water. Like the suffering of the soul, the dissatisfaction of the soul is because of coming out of Krishna consciousness. But then the fish looks at a mirage and he thinks there is water. And of course, fishes cannot move on the land, so in that sense the analogy is hypothetical. But you can just visualize it. The fish is running towards the mirage. And it comes to a mirage and doesn't get any water. Now the solution is to go back to the ocean. But then sees another mirage. Another mirage. It keeps going. Now the chase of every mirage, not only is it disappointing, but it is also more and more alienating from the ocean. More and more distancing from the ocean. And the longer and more troublesome will be the journey of the fish back to the ocean. So like that, the more a person indulges in self-gratification, the more it becomes difficult to return back to Krishna consciousness. Why? Because it's like the ocean is transcendence. And the mirages are in goodness, passion and ignorance. So ignorance is the furthest away from transcendence. And that's why the more and more a person indulges in self-gratification, the more and more he is going away from transcendence. The more and more he is going away from the very happiness that he is chasing. And that's why the more a person is seeking pleasure in self-gratification, the more it becomes difficult to find pleasure in Krishna consciousness. Because the more one is going into the lower and lower modes. And in the mode of ignorance or passion, it's difficult to get any higher taste. Occasionally by Krishna's mercy we can experience higher taste. But it's in the mode of goodness that we start experiencing the higher taste on a steady basis. So that's why a one-time indulgence, we may think that it's not very harmful, I'm not going to fall down by this. Yes, we may not fall down immediately, but we make our work more difficult. We make our future work more troublesome. It's more and more effort and more trouble. The very goal that we want to achieve, experience a higher taste, we take ourselves away from that. And then it takes more time to come back to that. So that's why, Maha Shano Maha Papma. Now Srila Prabhupada, in the purport, takes this to a very broad level. He says the conditioned soul is suffering for happiness more and more and more, and doesn't get it. And then, he comes to the level of Athato Brahma Jignyasa. After being baffled in the pursuit for happiness, he comes to the level of spiritual inquiry. And that Brahman is Janmadhyasthirtaha. Brahman is the source of everything. So Prabhupada explains that the Brahman is the source of everything, means that it is the source even of lust. So it is only in the Vedic culture that the source of lust is explained. In the other traditions, religious traditions, it is acknowledged that lust is a great enemy and it has to be curbed according to the particular level that the religion is revealing or is encouraging its people to practice. All religions talk that one has to curtail lust. But a philosophical explanation of where lust originates from is not forthcoming anywhere. So the Vedic scriptures explain that, you know, the male-female attraction is present in the world because it is present in the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, the God, Krishna, has his greatest devotees, the gopis, or the other forms of the Lord also have their consorts. Now their relation is not exactly bodily or sexual in the sense in which we understand it, but the male-female attraction is there. And in fact, you know, the female form is the most suited for service. The female form is the most suited for service. You know, women, actually, if they mentally, internally accept the role of being homemakers and mothers, they are actually happy. But because of social propaganda, that they also want to have career and they also want to have a social profile, but that makes them insecure. That makes them vulnerable. To just explicit gross sexual exploitation by men or the subtle sexual exploitation in the workplace also. So that's natural for women to have the role of being servants. So that's why in the spiritual realm, Krishna wants to provide all his devotees the best facility for serving him. So therefore the best devotees get the best facility for serving him. And the best facility for service is the female form. So in that sense, we should not see the gopis as women. We should see the gopis first as devotees. And the female form is a facility, the best facility provided by Krishna for his devotees to render service to him. So, of course, eternally speaking, the gopis have their swarupa of a female form. So it's not that they were devotees and they were given a female form. But the point here is, just like, you know, it's not that Radha Krishna were two at one time and they became one. Although Chaitanya Charitamrita says, ekatmana pura deha bhedam gatavata tachaikyam. That there is one absolute truth was manifested as two and the two became one. So, when we talk about this in the spiritual realm, this is not in a time denotational sense, it's in a philosophical sense. In a philosophical sense, to understand the subtleties of the principles and the relationships, these explanations are given. So like that, the gopis eternally have the female form. But why do they have the female form? So that is the, because they can render the best service to Krishna. So, the original attraction between the Lord and his devotees is pervertedly reflected in this world when the conditioned soul wants to imitate Krishna. So when we want to imitate Krishna, we also want to enjoy the female form. So the soul who occupies a male form wants to enjoy the female form from outside, and the soul who occupies a female form wants to enjoy the female form from inside. But essentially the same Purusha Bhava, the enjoying mentality. And when the Bhagavad Gita says that Urdhva Moolam Adha Shakham, this world is a perverted reflection of the spiritual world, now that principle, what it means, is explained by our Gaudiya Vaishnava Acharya through the revelation of the pastimes of Radha Krishna. So all the relationships that are there in this world are there in the spiritual world. The Sakyaras, the Vatsalyaras, and the Madhuryaras. And these relationships, if you see, you know, somebody wants to become a devotee, you know, he has to give up these three rasas. First is Sakyaras. Your friends don't want us to become devotees, isn't it? So we have to choose, do we want Krishna or do we want what is that's the first attachment that you have to give up. But after that, then there is the parents, of course. The Vatsalyaras is highest. Generally, if somebody wants to become a devotee, if he wants to become a Brahmacharya, the parents' problem is there for maybe 1 or 2 or 3 years. But after that, it gets over. But then, the Madhuryaras' problem is there for a much longer time. You know, maybe about 20, 30 years it stays. And similarly, even if somebody becomes a Grihastha, the parents are initially opposed, but eventually they accept, they understand, my son has his own life. But the problem of wanting to imitate Krishna through the Madhuryaras is actually there throughout the life. So that's the meaning there. What is the highest in the material, in the spiritual realm, becomes the lowest. So because, you know, each of these are progressively deeper and deeper forms of imitating Krishna. That's why Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes that the root cause of our coming to the material world is the desire to imitate Gopinath. He doesn't use the word Krishna, he uses the word specifically Gopinath. So, when we understand the philosophy of Krishna consciousness nicely, then at least we get a clear understanding of what is happening in the material, what the attachments are and how we can give them up. So therefore, in this material world, everybody is trying to imitate Krishna. And the force that impels people to imitate Krishna in the strongest way is lust. And therefore, lust cannot be given up without turning to Krishna and surrendering to Krishna. Now, some people might be able to control their senses just because they are so much in sattva-guna from this life or from a previous life. Or they might have some willpower and determination. But generally speaking, then the gross lust may be controlled and get converted into subtle lust. Now there is right adoration distinction that will come up. So, of course, that is a different discussion which we will not get into right now about subtle sex. But generally speaking, it is not so easy on one's own to control lust. Now, in the next three verses, Krishna will describe how lust bewilders us. And in the subsequent three verses, he will describe how one can overcome lust. Yes, true. Regarding the? Yeah. Correct. The? See, the modern ethic is towards non-violence, because the world has seen two world wars and now we have nuclear weapons of mass destruction. But Prabhupada explains that non-violence may be a factor of diplomacy, but is never a factor of principle. For a politician, what does that mean? That means as a matter of diplomacy, we may decide, okay, let's avoid violence and have a proper agreement politically. But it's not a matter of principle. Now, if we look at capital punishment means hanging a criminal. If you don't hang the criminal, like now there are this 26-level killer Kasab. No. Now he has been in jail, and to provide him security, so many crores have been spent. So basically, when we don't hang a person, what are we doing? We may say that we are being compassionate and tolerant to him. But actually, we are being cruel to the other people. How are we being cruel to the other people? You know, how is that person being maintained in the jail? By the people's taxes. So probably, the person who has been murdered, that murdered person's relatives are paying the taxes to maintain the murderer. So, it's no common sense at all. Yes, if people can be reformed, they should be reformed. But there are certain people who cannot be reformed in this lifetime. And they have to get a particular punishment by which only they can be reformed. So yes, the Vedic culture does talk about non-violence. But non-violence is for Brahmanas, it is not for Kshatriyas. If Kshatriya is not violent, then he cannot maintain discipline in society. As in, there is Shastra and there is Shastra. So, Shastra should not be the first resort. The first resort should be Shastra. By Shastra, we explain what is right and what is wrong. So, actually Shastra provides us just with knowledge. It, not only knowledge, it provides knowledge, training and inspiration. Three things. Knowledge, okay, what is to be done. Training, how it is to be done. Inspiration, see, there are so many people doing it. So, Shastra provides us these three things. The knowledge, training and inspiration. And when these three facilities provided by Shastra, people can become inspired to follow the right path. But those who are not ready to follow the right path, for them there has to be Shastra. Shastra is necessary. But it should not be the first resort. I mean, Shastra don't force, you just have to do this or you'll go to hell. That is fanatism. Because I have philosophical knowledge. Why you should do this? Why you should not do this? Also, use the means. You know, if in modern society, if we tell people, okay, you can watch television, you can go to movies, you can work in a very materialistic environment, but you have to be celibate. That's not possible. You know, you have to provide training to people. There has to be a proper culture. There has to be a means of purification. There has to be means for developing sense control. So without training, the imposition of sense control will be just oppressive. Like now, one thing about Islam, which is good in one sense, is that they impose the regulations of the scripture quite strongly. Like women are supposed to wear burqa, but you know they have very few means to offer higher taste to people. And because of that, you see, in the Middle East, there are several small countries. So in some countries, you know, the women are wearing burqa. And in just a neighboring country, I think it's Bahrain, where, you know, prostitution is the biggest business. So So what the people do is, in their country they will have women wearing burqa, but then you have to travel over to the neighboring country and they do all sorts of degraded things. So if we just impose by force, it won't work. It won't work for very long. But then at the same time, some amount of force is also required. If the force is not there, if the fear of punishment is not there, then the scriptural regulation is not taken seriously. And even those who can follow it will think, okay, even if I don't follow it, it's okay. Or some once in a while, it doesn't matter. That's why in discipline, generally the discipline should be done by inspiration. But in discipline, a part of discipline is also some sort of corrective action. Some sort of, the punishment is not just for the sake of punishing, but it is for the purpose of correcting. Does that answer the question? So, can we complete this section? If you don't mind, we'll try to have some time at the end. So, now in the next verse, Krishna is telling how this lust covers us up. Dhume navriyate vahane yatha darsho malena cha yathol benavrito garbhar tatha tene damavritam. Yes, translation. Yes. So, Bhaktivinoda Thakur in his commentary explains that these three coverings refer to three different kinds of species. So, dhumen avriyate vahaneer. This is fire is covered by smoke. This refers to the soul covered by a human body. Yatha darsho malena cha. Mirror covered by smoke refers to animal species. And ulben avrito garbham, embryo covered by womb, refers to plants and trees. Now, these three analogies have one thing in common and one thing which is progressively increasing in degree. One is that there is some sort of covering in all of them. That is common to all. But the second is that the covering is thicker and it takes longer to get rid of. It's like if smoke is covering a fire, what we have to do is? We have to actually blow it and then it goes away. Now blowing also has to be done carefully. Sometimes you blow and the smoke comes into your eyes and ears and nose and then it just makes things worse. So that's why Prabhupada says that, like that, you have to remove lust, but you have to remove lust in a very intelligent way. If you try to suppress lust without knowing how to do it, it can backfire. That's why when Prabhupada went to America, the common theory over there was that, you know, why did World War take place? Because, you know, that was a very strange theory, but it has some basis in fact. That they said that actually when people don't control, people when artificially try to control lust, then they become violent. And that violence leads to individual violence and mass violence. Now in one sense it is true, you know, that lust when it is frustrated, it leads to anger. So, in the human form of life, the covering by lust is like the smoke covered by smoke covering a fire. It can be removed by the Prabhupada, right, by the expert guidance of the spiritual master. One can remove the smoke. On the other hand, yatha darsho malena cha, a mirror covered by smoke. Now when we talk about mirror covered by smoke, the word covered by dust. It is not just a mirror with some spots of dust on it. It's covered by dust completely. So you cannot even see that there is a mirror, you cannot see there is a reflection. So the animals, they are in that level of consciousness where they live, they exist, but they are not aware of their existence. That means, in general, now scientists, they say that, many scientists try to argue that animals don't have they are not conscious. Although we can see that they have emotions. And you know, probably that scientist who says this also has a dog whom he loves. And the dog, he says, you see that the dog has emotions. But one of the attributes of consciousness is self-consciousness. Self-consciousness means to be aware of oneself. For example, you know, we can at least by a mental act, think of ourselves from a distant perspective. And I can think, okay, I can think that I am standing there and I am observing myself. You see how I look like, what I behave, how I can do. So we can be aware of our thoughts. We can be aware of our existence to some extent. So self-consciousness or self-awareness is not possible for animals. And self-awareness is the basis of self-transformation. How? Because self-awareness means, okay, that time this was the situation and I got angry. But I did not have got angry. I acted in this way, but I could have acted in this way. So only when there is self-awareness, then can be self-transformation. But for animals, all their actions are based on instincts. And because they're based on instincts, there is no scope for transformation. An animal is going to act in the same way. So that's why the animals, ahara, nidra, abhaya, maithun, that is the same activity which they keep doing. And the animals don't, generally speaking, improve themselves. Now, if a crow has a particular kind of nest, it's not that the next generation crow is going to develop a better nest. No, it develops the same nest, same kind of nest. But there is another bird which has a very sophisticated nest. And the weaver bird, for example, will have a very sophisticated nest. But all the weaver birds will have the same kind of sophisticated nest. So, that's another problem with evolution theory, that they say that actually we develop, the abilities evolve, but we don't see anywhere in observation the animals doing the same species. There are different species which do eating, sleeping, mating, depending in different ways. But the member of the same species over generations don't change the way they do eating, sleeping, mating. They keep doing it in the same way all the time. So, that's because you know, their behavior is controlled only by instincts. So, that's because there is no self-awareness, there can be no self-transformation. In human beings, self-awareness is there, self-transformation is possible. So, adarsho malena cha, that the mirror is covered by dust. So, it's so much covered that one cannot even perceive that there's a mirror and there I can see myself in the mirror. It'll take a long time to cleanse the mirror. Now, Srila Prabhupada links this analogy with Cheto Dharpmanam Archanam. And he said that the holy name is a means to cleanse the mirror of the mind. So, most of us may have human forms, but we do have animal-like consciousness. And that's why we need the purification. That we can come to human consciousness and then transcendental consciousness. So, that's why this analogy is appropriate for us, and Prabhupada uses it over there. And then beyond that is the Ulben Avruto Garbha. So now the embryo in the womb, first of all, the embryo is very much covered and cramped. But more importantly, the embryo cannot come out of the womb till a specific time is over. In the human form, it is 9 months. 10 to 10 months. So like that, the soul in the plant and tree species, there is no scope for self-realization till a particular time period has passed. Till the soul goes to the lower species and comes to the species like a human species where it can strive for self-realization, the soul cannot become free from the bondage of lust. So actually, you know, in general, nature gives us facilities according to our desires. So if somebody wants to be lusty, then that person may be given a body of a pigeon or something like that. But even that is under regulation. If somebody is very indiscriminately, grossly degraded, then nature can put them in a body where there is not even the scope for lust. In the trees, there is no, practically, you know, if we see among eating, sleeping, mating, defending, the only thing that a tree does is eating. In a literal sense, you know, it is just sending its roots down and drinking the water and getting some minerals to it. Sleeping, now we can say that it is sleeping, but you know, it is not lying down comfortably, it has to stand all the time. Then mating also, what is a mating? It produces some seed, and the seeds go from one flower to another flower and through some medium like a bird or a butterfly or something like that. But you know, there is no, practically speaking, there is no pleasure is there in it. because the tree at one place is already flown to some other place, and then it comes in a flower. And so actually at that level of consciousness and defending, now some trees have some capacities to defend. You know, they may have touch me not, may have capacity to withdraw and things like that. But most trees don't have any capacity. So, you see, the consciousness is covered not only from a spiritual point of view, but even from a material point of view, it is very, very, as in the word, sankuchit, constricted consciousness. And so a particular amount of time has to pass before that soul will get a human body. The important thing with respect to lust is that lust not only deprives us of our spiritual potential, our spiritual opportunities, but lust can deprive us of even our material potential and material opportunities. So Prabhupada explains in the purport that those who have a great exhibition of lust, they are put into bodies like trees. So even material point of view, they are quite incapacitated. So what does this covering actually do? As described in the next verse. Avritam jnanam etena jnanino nitya vairina kamarupena kaunteya dushpurena nilena cha. So, yes, translation.
Thus, the white living entity's pure consciousness becomes covered by its eternal enemy, the form of lust, which is never satisfied and which burns like fire.
Avritam jnanam etena. So what is it that is covered? It is knowledge. It's not just a physical covering. Somebody is covered with a blanket. It's not exactly like that. Although we can consider it like that to understand it. But it is a blanket, you can't see anything. But lust is not like that. Lust not only covers that true knowledge, but gives us false knowledge. That's not a model makes us forget that I'm the soul. But also makes us think I am a body. So it does both these things. So it's not just like a blanket that covers us, but it's like a coloring glass which distorts our vision. Avritam jnanam etena jnani knows. The soul is called as jnani over here. But this jnani doesn't refer to the transcendental seeker who is on the jnanam or jnani. Here he is talking about how jnana is a natural faculty of the soul. Sat chitananda chit. The soul is naturally knowledgeable. Jnanino. Krishna is a very strong word over here. Nitya vairina. Vairina means enemy. Remember the previous verse 37? Iha vairina. So the better enemy in this world. So Krishna is saying, nitya vairina, eternal enemy. Now, this nitya vairina is rhetorical. Like nitya baddha, eternally conditioned. So nobody is eternally conditioned. One time Hayadri Prabhu asked Prabhupada, Prabhupada, is hell eternal? So in the Christians have that, the Semitic religions generally have the idea of eternal hell where you have to suffer. Prabhupada says nothing except ecstatic devotional service to Krishna is eternal. Everything else is temporary. But from the point of view of the perspective of the conditioned soul, it can go on for a very, very long time. So as long as we are in the material world, we are conditioned. As long as in the material world, lust is our enemy. That's why nitya vairina. Life after life after life. You know, an ordinary enemy will just kill us and that's the end of the enmity. But lust is the enemy which causes our death physically. We experience death because of our attachment to the body. And the attachment to the body is because of lust. But then it follows the next body and keeps torturing us. Nitya vairina. Who is this enemy? Kama rupena kaunteya. It is in the form of lust. Dushpuren analencha. Analen means like fire. And dushpuren is never satisfied. It is like a blazing flame which keeps burning, burning and is never satisfied. So, in this purport, Prabhupada writes, the last sentence can somebody read it? So, it's one of the most penetrating sentences I have ever read in my life. The last sentence of the purport.
While one enjoys this gratification, maybe that there is some feeling of happiness. But actually, the so-called feeling of happiness is the ultimate enemy of the sense.
Prabhupada is taking this point further. He's saying, it's not just lust is the enemy, it is the so-called feeling of happiness that is the enemy. See, lust cannot force us. Lust promises some pleasure, and that craving for that pleasure is our enemy. That experience of pleasure is what prompts us and tempts us and goads us again and again. So So that pleasure actually binds us in suffering. Just like for a fish, the bait offers some pleasure. But that so-called feeling of pleasure is the ultimate enemy of that shellfish. So that pleasure which is there in lust is not meant to make us happy, it is meant to trap us. It is meant to make us miserable. And that's why that so-called feeling of happiness is the ultimate enemy of the sense enjoyer. So this is something which takes time for us to recognize. But the pleasure is there. In the materialistic people can't understand this pleasure, why can't you enjoy it? No, it's there and it's there, meant for enjoyment. Yes, it is meant for enjoyment in the immediate sense. But in the overall sense, it is meant for not enjoyment but entanglement. It is meant to trap us. Trap us in bodily consciousness. So, it keeps tempting us and promising us and in that way trapping us. And you know, one of the distinguishing attributes of Krishna consciousness as compared to various other religions is clear identification of the enjoying mentality. Now, this is the enjoying mentality, this is the cause of suffering, and this is what we have to give up. Otherwise, many times, in many religions, of course, that can happen within Krishna consciousness also, and the enjoying mentality is aggravated by the means of religion. That means that religion is meant to, like we have dharma, artha, kama, moksha. So now, the Vedic culture, the Vedas do talk about dharma, artha, kama. But the Upanishads talk about moksha so much. But if you look at the Bible and the Quran, it's mostly dharma, artha, kama. And moksha is, some things are there, but it's not so much. The promises of paradise, if we see, is also filled with kama. The promises of enjoyment in heaven which are there, they are also filled with so much sensuous imagery. So the idea is not to give up lust, but to temporarily curtail lust. It is not so that, according to rules of religion, so that one can enjoy better in future. But Krishna consciousness, it clearly differentiates that this is the cause of entanglement. And the purpose of religion is not to fulfill this desire, but to purify of this desire, to get rid of this desire. And yes, it's a tall order, it's a very difficult task, but we are provided the means for doing it. On the other hand, if the religion is not very clear, that's why the Bhagavatam uses the word Kaitava Dharma. It's a very striking phrase to use, you know. Dharma is something which is meant to be so pure, so uplifting, Kaitava, cheating religion. Cheating religion means any religion that does not purify the conditioned soul of the enjoying mentality, does not identify the enjoying mentality as the cause of suffering, not the cause of enjoyment. That is the Kaitava Dharma. So you know, Krishna consciousness in that sense is not just like Hinduism, Christianity, Islam. It's way above. Because whether it is Hindus, Christians or Muslims, all of them, they have the enjoying mentality. And most of the times they think that their religion is a civilized way to fulfill the enjoying mentality. That's all. So, that's why it's not so easy to get out of material entanglement. So, we'll do the next verse and then we will continue tomorrow. Now, after describing that, it covers the knowledge. Actually, how can somebody cover my knowledge? You can cover me, you can tie my hands and legs. How can my knowledge be covered? So, where is this lust situated by which it covers the knowledge? That Krishna describes in the next verse. Indriyani mano buddhi asya adhishtanam uchyate etair vimohayatesha jnanam avritya dehinam.
Senses, the mind and the intelligence are sitting places of this lust. Through them, lust covers the real knowledge of the living entity and the witness.
Yes. So, how is our knowledge covered? Because our knowledge acquiring apparatus is infected. The senses, the mind and intelligence, they are our knowledge acquiring apparatus. And that itself is infected, that itself is contaminated by lust. And that's why, although we have senses, we have mind, we have intelligence, and they have the capability of knowing, but because they are infected by lust, they generally see in terms of the enjoying mentality. Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur wrote a very, one of the earliest books he wrote was called Bangi Samajikta. It was in Bengali. So in that book, he counters the
the Christian, the Western criticism of Indian religion, Indian spirituality as being very lazy and unproductive. You know, people just don't do anything practical. There are people who are starving and suffering and you're just sitting and meditating and praying and you don't do anything practical. Of course, you know, that the kings were, the practical part of spiritual of society was done by the kings. They were meant to maintain the cows, they maintain the farmhouses and many social, the transcendentalists were meant to teach people to go beyond it. But the point is, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that, you know, the conditioned soul in this world has jnanendriyas and karmendriyas. So, in the animal stage, the karmendriyas are primarily active and the jnanendriyas are meant just to assist the karmendriyas. Isn't it? You know, the of the and a lion. Okay, he says, okay. Where is the deer? Jnan see in the season, and then the main activity is done by the karmendriyas. The legs run and the teeth catch. This is at the animal level of consciousness, the karmendriyas are primarily active and the jnanendriyas are meant to assist. But he says at the enlightened level of consciousness, you know, one understands this world is just a display of illusion. And one has to intelligently act. So primarily the jnanendriyas that are active and the karmendriyas are subordinate. So the main activity is jnanendriya. Okay, this is happening, this means this, this is happening, this means this, this means this. And therefore, I should do this. So, as one is spiritually more advanced, the jnanendriyas become more active and the karmendriyas become less active. So, if you see this, in the karma kanda means, the karmendriya is active, okay, the Vedic scriptures tell this ritual, you do this ritual, you go to heaven. Hey, but who is it that is empowering that I do this yajna and go to heaven? Don't bother about it, just go to heaven and enjoy. The karmendriyas are more active, jnanendriyas are less active. But once you come to the jnanakanda level, okay. What is all this? You go to heaven, you come back. Come on, do this yajna. But why should I do this yajna? What is going to happen by this? What is the armature? So you start thinking more. So the jnanendriyas become more active. And then, that is the jnanakanda level. Now beyond this both is the bhakti level. Where actually the soul becomes active. And the soul will engage both the karmendriyas and the jnanendriyas. Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam Bhakti Ruchyate. Now, see such a fabulous pastor plan, isn't it? Initially, most of us are karmendriyas are active. So the scriptures say, okay, act, 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 but act according to dharma. That's the way the scriptures. But then there is Upanishads. Okay, now you have engaged your senses as well as you wanted. You saw that it didn't give much happiness. It just gave you exhaustion. So now, use your intellect. Try to understand. Understand. And then go beyond that to actually come to the level of the soul. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that even from the point of view of objective spiritual analysis, one whose jnanendriyas are active is more advanced than one whose karmendriyas are active. Because he is spiritually more thoughtful, more insight. But he says a Vaishnava is beyond that also. Vaishnava is not just an inactive contemplator, he is an active servant. Is actually using both the karmendriyas and the jnanendriyas in the service of the Lord. But the principle is that our karmendriyas at our current stage, they basically act to fulfill the promptings of lust. And because we are more or less influenced by lust, so the jnanendriyas perceive mostly the promptings of lust. Now, you know, an ordinary person, you know, there is one big page of newspaper and on that page there is one picture of a woman. The first place that the eyes will go to, the jnanendriya will not see anything else. It will just start, it will go there. Why? Because lust is directing the senses. So that's what it means. Indriyani mano buddhir. So first, our senses are attracted to sense objects. And it's not that just the senses are attracted to sense objects and that's enough. Actually, then once the senses perceive a sense object, then the mind takes over. And the mind's activity is imagination. Start imagining it. This is like this. And then intelligence activity is planning. Planning how I can get this. So in this way, the conditioned soul's faculties are controlled by lust. So the senses see the sense objects. The mind imagines how the sense objects will give me enjoyment. And then the intelligence plans how I can get this object and I will enjoy. And I said, Asya Adhishtana Muchyate. Adhishtata Deva means the presiding deity. So the presiding deity of the senses, mind, and is Krishna is telling you, last. And Etai Vimohayatyesha. In this way, it bewilders the condition. Jnanam Avritti Dehinam. It covers the knowledge of living entity. And after describing that, Prabhupada describes in very graphic terms. He says, you know, that actually lust comes from the senses. And then it's like a battle going on. It knocks down the senses, and then the next is the mind. And after the mind, it goes to the intelligence. Then the intelligence becomes the headquarters. And from the, once the lust has conquered intelligence, then like from the headquarters, all the instructions go, do this, do this, do this, go like that. Once intelligence is conquered, lust becomes, lust occupies intelligence as the headquarters, then it starts controlling all the faculties and makes the soul act in all kind of wrong ways. And next verse is Krishna will describe how one can actually combat and control and conquer this lust. That we'll discuss in tomorrow's class. To quickly summarize, we started by discussing about how it is lust which distracts one from the path of beauty. The Vedic scriptures describe that lust is the expression of our wanting to imitate Krishna. Through the imitating especially Krishna's Madhurya's pastimes. And then we discussed about how lust covers to different degrees in the various species. And lastly, lust sabotages, it perverts our knowledge acquiring faculty. And that's why we have to be very careful in dealing with this lust. How we deal with it, we'll discuss tomorrow. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaura Bhakta Vrinda ki, Jai Gaura Premanand. Thank you.